Okay, one thing I wanted to mention before I resume is we've gotten all the videos and audios for lectures 1 and 2 in place. I think that's all set. So what's happened is instead of doing audio, we now have in place through the projection system a video of what's on the screen with my voice in the background, almost like we're doing a documentary. And I find this is way more useful than the audio by itself. If, for example, you've missed a lecture, because you're able to put together pretty closely the topic on the screen versus the words I'm saying. And if I switch back and forth to the document camera, that's captured too. Let me warn you that the files are big. The first one, which used this older guy, was about 2 gigabytes. So you may not want to download that unless you have a really good internet connection. But you don't have to. You can stream it. The newer ones are closer to 1 gigabyte, which is still fairly large depending on how it goes. But which should be the case that most browsers, the ones I tried, when I clicked on it, it just brought up the appropriate video player. It's stored in format of a video. And again, it's got the little bar there, and you start it out, and you can pause it. Now, the one thing that wasn't done, because the people doing it don't quite know our format, is we have these 2 15-minute breaks, and the thing keeps playing then. So what you should do is you hit around an hour in, the spot where everything kind of goes dead. What you want to do is skip ahead about 15 minutes, and then you resume where I started segment 2 or segment 3. It was a little too hard to really tell the AV people here where something begins and ends. I don't want to tell them to do it exactly at an hour because I may run short or long or something. So when you're watching it, if something all of a sudden seems to go dead, check the elapsed time, and if it's one of these magic breaks, you really haven't lost anything. I mean, if you've got a fancy video editor, you can edit it yourself, but then you have to download it. And I assume probably most people here who have a desktop, that's Ethernet connected instead of Wi-Fi connected. Is that true? Yeah, it probably is. One of the dirty secrets people don't tell you is that if you're in a big group like this, not everybody could possibly be using Wi-Fi simultaneously simply because there are too few channels and too many bodies. You know, it's like Taco Tuesday or something where everybody wants to be first in line but can't be. And one bit, well, you get more lines, but at this stage, I think they're trying to find more lines for Wi-Fi because it's gotten so darn popular. But it's the case now that usually people that are hardwired, that is, there's a cable, and you don't have to sign up to a Wi-Fi server, those things tend to be way faster. So on one of those, downloading may be reasonable. I'm talking about maybe 5 minutes or less, and that's up to you. So I want to warn you about that if you're, saying going on the road or something, and you're one of the things where you want to put it on your personal computer or something. I guess most airplanes now don't have Wi-Fi service unless you pay for it, or has that changed? I was one of those things. So it's kind of iffy. So if you're in an environment where you don't have Wi-Fi and you don't have a portable hotspot or something like that, you may have to download it if you want to access it. Unfortunately, depending on how you pipe it out, a gigabyte is still a lot of data. And that's the way it is. We'll probably need bigger bandwidth, but that's harder and harder to come by. So it's one of the realizations we have. Making computing too popular is really bad. It's like, in the old days, the national parks were hardly used by anybody because people didn't routinely have cars and they didn't even know about them. And there used to be these great national parks in the West that nobody was in. It's like you owned the whole thing yourself, or you go miles before you came up with someone. Now if you go to one of the popular ones in the dead of summer, you know, it's as bad as, you know, going to Wisconsin Dells or something, except there they don't have the water slides. You get to take a chance, you know, in the geyser, step in Old Faithful and get yourself shot up into the air before you get yourself shot by the guards. So anyway, let's continue on then. What's that? And by the way, one other thing I want to say. Somebody was asking me about the homework during the break. I haven't gotten to quite the full notation yet to understand what these questions are asking, but I'll get to them. So right now I'm talking about the mathematical form. These particular equations, definitions, are in the JLEX form, which means we have to introduce a little bit of notation. I hope I'll get through most of that today. If I don't, it's still on the slides. If you viewed the slides before and said, my God, is he going to get through all that material in 2.5 hours? And the answer is probably not. But I wanted to have some continuity so that if I got just to the point where I'm getting some good stuff and time ran out, you could simply go ahead and read ahead and get a lot of what I was hoping to say. And, of course, I'll pick it up then next week. So that's one of the problems, is that with a week between, there's kind of a dead time in between that if you want to read ahead, I certainly encourage it. So it turns out a superscript, a plus, is like star, except it means one or more iterations. And in fact, plus is probably used more than star, because plus means there's always going to be at least one string, possibly a sequence of strings selected. So P plus would say, go into P and choose one string, or a second, or a third, or so on, choosing as many of them as you want. But you're not allowed to use lambda. So if I was doing identifiers, the set of 52 characters plus would be almost exactly what I want. The only difference is I'm missing the actual digits, which usually appear in identifiers, as long as they're not the initial character. And here it is. And in fact, it turns out this one is a really good one, because one of the tokens we happen to have in our language is a bit string, a literal, which is only zeros and ones, Boolean, followed by the letter B. It says this is not to be considered base 10, this is to be considered binary or base 2. And it turns out that one is useful in some cases when you're doing computations, doing logical AND or logical OR, where you can actually add or remove bits by doing an appropriate AND or OR with the appropriate constant. If you've never done it, it's something that sometimes is very handy. It turns out sometimes you find it easier to say, here's the characters I don't want rather than the characters I want. So you're able to go ahead and say that not A says I'll take any character that's not in A. So, for example, if you wanted to specify a definition of unprintables, and we'll have to do that, one way of doing it would be to specify all the printables. That is everything that actually prints out as a visible character, including blank, and say, these are fine. Give me the things that are not these characters. And those would consider things like tabs and new lines and carriage returns and the bell character and all the ones that happen to be there. So that's one of the reasons why that's useful. Sometimes easier to say, this is what I don't want. So it depends on what stage you're going to pizza. What kind of pizza do you want? And I have had this problem. What kind of pizza do you want? And everybody would say, anything but anchovies. And you don't see anchovies anymore, but I used to love anchovy pizzas, and they're very rare these days. You got to, you know, hard to find them. So in this case, sometimes it's easier to say what you don't want rather than what you want. So here's an example. So when we're doing comments, single line comments, a single line comment typically ends at an end of line. So it says in this particular case, what's the body of a single line comment? It starts with two slashes, and it's anything and everything but an end of line character. You don't want an end of line character, otherwise it would try to eat the next line and the next, and you don't want that. So in this case, instead of saying all the characters that are good, you say the character that you don't want, and everything else is acceptable. And we'll see an example of that a little later. It's possible, and here's a case where my printout turned out not to be very good, too. So if you read the string, the second paragraph where it says, we define S, there's kind of an ugly splotch there. That was supposed to be an overbar that somehow didn't carry over. Similarly, three lines from the bottom, or two lines from the bottom, there's an overbar. There's an overbar. Here's my... There's an overbar that looks like a dot dash. So, you know, if you remember your Morse code, that's A, da-da. You know, so in this case, that's meant to be an overbar. If you have paper, you could write it in, otherwise make a note. And that simply represents the complement of all elements in the regular set. So you say, here's a set of what I don't want in terms of not characters, but strings, and I'll take everything else. That's used less frequently than the one that's not on characters. So this overbar represents a complement, and mathematically that's used. And for some reason, it didn't come out cleanly, and I'm not quite sure how to fix it. But so I thought in this case, I'd just warn you. And maybe this is the case where it came out beautifully on Windows systems and just screwed up on Macs. I don't know. But that's an error I caught. And just as with star and plus, we could also use a fixed superscript like squared or cubed that would represent exactly two or three choices. So, for example, I wanted 32-bit integers. One way to write them in this notation is 0 or 1 to the 32nd, which means take a 0 or 1, your choice, and keep appending them until you've got something 32 long. So it represents all possible legal bit patterns that would appear in a computer word. And that's kind of an important notion, because in a computer word, there's nothing but bits. Whether those 32 bits are part of a string or part of an integer, part of a program, part of something yet to be invented, it's interpretation. And the bits are the only thing that's actually in the computer memory. So something like that, when you're programming, is useful to say, this is any possible pattern that could be in a computer word, and I can then work from there. Okay, let's do some examples. So we're going to assume that in advance we have D defined as the set of all digits. That's 0 or 1 or 2 or etc. And L is the set of all upper and lowercase letters, A or B or C, all the way to Z in both upper and lower. So I'm having those predefined just to make the notation cleaner to write. So here's what I was just promising, and this turns out to be the obvious but not quite accurate definition that we have. So this is a single line comment. It appears in Java, it appears in C++, and it appears in CSX. It says double slash is not a magic character, so they represent themselves. So give me two consecutive slashes, then give me anything that's not the end of line character. The end of line character is sometimes called the new line character. But the new line is in programming languages. This is still mathematics. So EOL is the name I'm attributing to the end of line character. So anything that's not an end of line star followed by an end of line. And it turns out that this definition is the one that's frequently used. When we get to CSX, we're going to see it's changed ever so slightly, and we're going to have to kind of psych out why. Turns out that the definition in CSX is actually a little bit better. But this one is certainly workable and very easy to understand. In a little bit, maybe today, maybe next time, we'll actually see how the matching process is generated from this def. Here's one that's a tad more complex. This is a fixed decimal literal that has digits on both the left and right-hand side. Many engineers require to have digits on both sides so you don't have something that begins with a decimal point or ends with a decimal point. Part of the trouble there being it can be easily misread. So in this case, a decimal literature says, give me one or more digits, then literally give me the decimal point, and then give me one or more digits. So 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and lots of others. Notice there's no limit to the number of digits because I don't know how much precision you want. There are computers, of course, which have single and double precision numbers. That is 32 and 64-bit floating point numbers. Some of the machines produced by IBM for high-quality computing in engineering and science is actually quad word. So it's not 32 or 64, but it's 128 bits. That's a lot of bits. Does anybody know, have they gone past quad word in hardware? That's a lot of memory in situation. And that's when you're doing really very precise calculations. But this sort of form would handle any of that. So if you want to have a definition of something that represents, I guess quad word can easily go, 40 or 50 digits, 40 or 50 decimal places, you can go ahead and do it. Here's a case that I alluded to earlier, but now we have it on paper, that we want to have an integer that is optionally signed with a plus or a minus, and since it's optional, we put that lambda in there, and the way to read that is choose one of the three, a plus sign, a minus sign, or a lambda. Plus is quoted because I don't want to be misunderstood as being the iterator plus, as I have on the far right. And then I say D is a set of digits, and you take one or more of those. So it's a run of digits prefixed by a plus, by a minus, or no prefix at all. So there's at least one example where lambda is a good way of saying you don't have to have a prefix if you don't want one. And here's the answer why the quotes are on the plus. Here's a comment. It's not the kind of comment we're familiar with, slash, star, and star, slash. And the reason for that is when we're doing the homework, we're going to kind of get into why slash, star, and star, slash, although widely used, is a very tricky one to get correct. And in fact, the homework is kind of cute in that it gives a number of answers. At least one of them for sure is wrong. The very first one I'll give you is definitely wrong. And you'll be able to figure out why. Of the rest, maybe some are right, maybe some are wrong. And what you have to do is say it's right, or if it's wrong, tell me why it's wrong. And we'll get into that a little bit more as we get into JLEX. So we have an alternative, and in our alternative, instead of beginning with slash star and star slash, we begin with double haystacks or double pound signs, if you would. So it says we only have anything in the body that's not a double pound sign or a double haystack. So it begins with double haystack and ends with it. And let's look what we have in the middle. We have the something star in the middle. So why do I have star? Because the comment body can be empty. That means I could have pound sign, pound sign, pound sign, pound sign, and it'd be a legal comment. Why would you want to have that? Well, it might be there as a reminder that I got to write a comment. But if you're like me and a lot of other programmers, you write the code first and the comments later. Now, I know your instructors say, this is terrible, you know, we have it all documented and everything. But what people tell you to do and what you do are two very different things. So how do I get a pattern that says inside there I can have a single pound sign, but I can't have two of them? So it says, give me a pound sign or a lambda. So if I want to have a pound sign, I can have it. If I don't want to have a pound sign, I can skip it. And then anything that's not a pound sign. And the claim is that the thing in the center cannot generate two consecutive pound signs. Why? Well, if I choose the pound sign, I have to have a non-pound sign. So bingo, can't do that. Or if I choose not to have a pound sign, I get other letters. There's no way inside the body I can generate two consecutive pound signs. I can have one. So inside the comment, I could have rear number one or something like that. But this is one that I chose partially because it's... No, that's why I do the lambdas. I say, do you want a pound sign yet? I say, no. Say again?
I can't be ABC and pound sign.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. But no, don't feel bad about this. This is programming of a sort. And it's kind of an odd programming because you're not programming in code. You're programming patterns. So the rule is two rules when you're doing this thing number one. You ask two questions. One, does it give me everything that I want? That was the thing that he was talking about. Namely, can I have a single pound sign anywhere I want it? And notice I can't really have a pound sign in the body anywhere I want it. I can't have, by this definition, a pound sign is the very last character in the body. And why is that? Because it would then grab the first pound sign of the terminator and say I'm done. And that final pound sign way out at the far right would be kind of a lost orphan. So it's a situation there that, in that particular situation, I'd be in trouble. Notice I can't have a pound sign at the beginning as long as I don't have a second one. So I could have pound sign, number one, pound sign. That's fine because I don't have two consecutive pound signs in the body and I don't terminate prematurely. So when you're looking at the definition, it says, does it give me everything I want? But then there's the other part. Does it give me something I didn't want? Is it possible to generate something that the rules say I don't? So if I had something that allowed a pound sign as the very last character of the body, I'd really be defining something that was one character too long. So it included a comment under my definition and an isolated pound sign that isn't used for anything else, and therefore it'd probably be picked up as garbage and get some kind of error message about an illegal character. So I think this is good to kind of motivate this level of programming. In some ways, it's cool because once I get this right, I'll have JLEX go ahead and do the tedium of preparing it. So think of this almost as if you're a great chef in one of the great restaurants or maybe one of the great cafeterias down the hall. And, you know, you get the recipe here and you say, if you mix this and this and this and this and this correctly, it's going to come out beautifully. And say, you go do it because I came up with the recipe and you got to implement it. In this case, I'll give the definition of what I consider a beautiful comment. And then I say to JLEX, you generate code that'll match exactly that and therefore handle comments correctly. So this part about the definition is something you had to do anyway. No, one of the things that is hard to realize is that when you define a language or a compiler, you're making a lot of fairly arbitrary decisions about what is allowed and not allowed. In some cases, the choice is obvious. In other cases, it's not, in which case you get to decide what is appropriate. So I know whenever I come in in here. I've never yet seen a traffic cop around Epic. Are traffic cops sometimes put speed traps around here? That's a shame. I would think Judy would be able to buy them all off by now and say, leave our people alone, or something like that. But it's the same thing, you know, with cops in situation. I think very few of them, unless they're really out for you, would, if there's a sign that says speed limit, what is it around here, 35 or 40? Say it's 35, and you clock out at 36. They're not going to give you a ticket. So, of course, the game in play is how much you can get away with. So it's situation there. If you have a hot-looking car, you got to be careful because they're going to be tighter. I had one student who had a bright red Camaro, and he never, ever got away with anything. If it was 35, by God, you know, he's looking around and say, here's a racer or a hot rodder. If he's 36, he gets the ticket. On the other hand, if you have some sort of beat up, what does Judy run? Some kind of old Volvo station wagon, is it?
Tesla.
What is it?
Tesla.
A what?
A Tesla.
She got a Tesla? How long? It used to be she had this old beat up car. She finally decided to spend $1 billion or $2 billion. Oh, cool. How many other people have Teslas? Oh, you're behind the scenes here. You go to Google in California, every other car in the parking lot's a Tesla. I tell you, it's amazing. I was in a hotel, and just a couple of doors down from the motel was a Tesla dealership. I walked in, and they didn't kick me out, but they weren't quite sure whether I was a real potential customer or just kind of a looky-loo. But they figured out, you know, these days, you know, it's computer people look all kinds of crazy sizes and shapes, so maybe I'm just an unknown billionaire, and I'll buy one. But I was just looking. So, but I'm glad Judy finally got her to spend a little bit on that. Or she didn't buy the company, did she? I mean, I know Tesla's been having some trouble. Maybe just buy it and get production car number one. So at any rate, there's that. One thing I want to warn you about, and this is a thing, people like scanning so much, sometimes they feel they can do more than a scanner is really able to do. One thing we have to do in programming languages is balance brackets, parens, braces, etc. And it turns out that a scanner cannot do that. You cannot have a token defined that has as many left parens as right parens in between and consider that a single token. And it turns out that later on, when we get a little to the theory of it, this is something that can actually be proved. Now, I'm going to hate doing this, and please forgive me because I always say it and people misuse it. But the insight is that regular expressions and their underlying implementation can't count. Now, it's always the same because I get an answer when in midterm or finals. Well, it's because they can't count. But can't count is not a formal definition. It's intuition. And how would you count, et cetera. But we'll get to that later. But the takeaway on this little part is there are certain reasonable structures, like balanced parens or balanced brackets, that cannot be written purely in the form of a token. Now, what you can do, and what we do is represent each bracket as a left or a right, feed it into the parser. And the parser can count, so it handles the job. It's a matter of simply handing the job off to the tool that can do it best. And the reason for it is that the set that has as many lefts as rights, they can be parens, they can be brackets, they can be begins and ends or something, is known not to be regular. And what happens if you program it up, you'll in some ways mismatch. And one of the cool things is this can actually be proved. It's not my feeling that I don't know how to do it, therefore it's impossible. I don't know how to do it because it is impossible is what happens. So, okay, now is a good spot to see. Did I give away all my... Are there any Project 2 definitions in the back that got back there? If you got an extra, bring it up. I want to project into or hand it off. That's right. Thank you. Oh, I got more. Then I got extras. Did anybody fail to get one when I handed them around? Okay. Pass that back, please. And, oh, these are extras. Okay. And here's one that's needed. Okay. Good. So get your definition, and we'll go to page 2. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to walk you through the definition of exactly the tokens we have in this language. cool. So each of these bullets represents a class of token. And some of them are very easy and others are not. So first off, we start out with the reserved words. The reserved words, as I mentioned, were simply a situation where they look like identifiers, as we'll see later, but they are not, because they have a particular meaning that we can't tamper with. Now, I mentioned previously, and since I have the screen on, this is easier to do, is why in the world do they have reserved words? Well, it turns out early programming languages didn't. And what would happen is if you wanted to have an identifier as any name, by gosh, this is a free country and you can do it. But it turned out in that language, you could have a program that looked like the following. And no, you're not having double vision. This is exactly what it is. If, then, else, else. I'm not stuttering or anything like that. What would happen is, well, first of all, you say, is this a reasonable-looking program? And say, no, it doesn't. There's something that looks awfully bad about it. But under the early rules, what would happen is, remember, if it's not a reserve, that means you can have an identifier used as an identifier or used as a special purpose symbol. It was called a keyword to distinguish it from a reserved word. So this first if is a keyword, but I simply decide to have a Boolean variable or a Boolean constant named if. So if, then, well, I could have a method call. But method call in the earlier languages did not have empty parens. If you ever wondered why it is that a call of a method with no arguments has these empty parens, you say, my gosh, that's silly. It made me type more. But no, the reason for it is it makes it easy to see something that you mean to be a call versus something that you mean to be perhaps a variable or a named constant. So if these two thens and elses had empty parens, no problemo. At least it's not as bad. But in that language, method calls of no arguments did not need arguments. So it says, if, then call the method name then, else call the method called else. So designers put up with that for a while and said, this is nonsense and it's not worth the bother. So the alternative was they went to reserved words. Well, you say, okay, that's fine too. We have reserved words, but then it's a question of having a limit. It's almost like in the news. Oh, more paper. We oftentimes hear about security clearances, and one of the troubles with security clearances is, well, I mean, only a few people like me know where the epic vault is down in the basement of Andromeda, where all the gold bars are kept, except for the one that paid for the Tesla. So you're not at that level yet. But trouble with having too many security levels is, you know, everybody gets confused. There's a trouble with some languages that had reserved words, and boy, did they have reserved words. There's a language called COBOL, which actually still bounces around. Maybe you come across people who have applications in COBOL. And COBOL was a language designed for non-mathematicians. If people hate numbers, COBOL is your language. And what they would do is they had, if you wanted to write down zero, you'd write it down. Okay, cool. But it turned out that you could also have something that represented a sequence of zero. And that was zeros. But zeros can be spelled two ways. So just for the lousy symbol zero in the back of the COBOL book, you say zero is a reserved word and zeros is a reserved word spelled the one way or the other. And it goes on and on and on. And the last time I looked at COBOL, probably had 10, maybe 20 pages of reserve words. And some of them, then when they try to make international, you get the French equivalent, and oh, it got terrible. So reserve words are cool, but don't get carried away. So here's what we have, and we'll get to the point where we explain what they are. But most of these are kind of self-evident what they are, because they're very similar to Java, and the ones that aren't, like const is a constant, void, well, that's used, etc. So reserved word comes first. In our language, upper and lowercase are indistinguishable, so you can case that any way you want. Lowercase is commonly used, but some people like to begin with a capital, like cap INT looks kind of nice, so you can use that if you want. Following that are anything that's not reserved. And notice I have kind of a misuse of notation. I have minus reserved, but we don't have a minus operator yet. So we're going to have a way of saying, conceptually, take anything in a reserved word class and pull them out of the identifiers. But the identifiers are, it turns out, in this particular case, it's got to begin with a letter. I don't care upper or lower. Then it can have any number of letters or digits. So a digit is legal in the middle or at the end of an identifier. So in this particular case, the second term has a star. I have to have at least one letter, but I can have additional letters or digits. But I can't have a reserved word. So we're going to have to figure out how to implement that. But I think it's pretty clear of using the notion of mathematical subtraction what I mean. That identifiers cannot clash with the reserved words, and reserved words have priority. Next one is an integer literal. And I've gone ahead and done a nasty here. Namely, our language, unlike other languages, does not begin with a minus sign. It begins with a tilde. And in this particular case, a tilde is an alternative to a minus sign. When we get around to code generation, I'll explain why. But what happens is when you write down, in most compilers, minus 10, the way that's translated is figure out, compute 10 and negate it. Change plus 10 to minus 10. And that makes sense, except it doesn't really work because in computers, the biggest possible negative integer in magnitude is one larger than the biggest possible positive integer. That means if I wanted to have the biggest possible negative integer, I cannot say, well, it's first going to be positive and I'll negate it, because I'll end up tripping across a number that's not representable. There's a lot of kludges around that. But one way to solve that is simply go ahead and have the tilde in front of it. And in that particular case, I'm warning somebody, this is not meant to be negation. This is meant to be a representation of a negative number. And in that way, I can avoid the problem. As I warned you earlier, besides having integer literals, we have bit strings. That's so that we can do logical things like and or. So that's a run of binary digits with a B capital or B lower, indicating that this is not decimal, it's base B or binary. So the thing, integer literal is obviously base 10, bit string is base 2. Okay, you say, no, this is not so bad. Maybe I can live with this. And now let's get to string literals, which is one of the nastier ones. In many cases, it's better to be able to decode these things from outside in instead of inside out. So it says a string literal begins with a double quote, see that at the far left, and ends with a double quote at the far right. Everything in between there is in parens and has a star. So what is the star telling me about strings? I can have zero characters in the strings, the empty string. I've argued that's a good thing, and I believe it is. So in this particular case, what can I have here in this particular case? Well, here I'm using the not. So there are a couple of symbols that are actually several characters that are a little bit nasty. So I don't want to have unprintable characters in the string. Why is that? Now, it turns out there is a way around it by using escaping, as I'll show shortly. But that means I can't actually type in a character that's a legal ASCII character and have it in the string. Well, one of the reasons is it's unprintable, it's unreadable. So I'd have a listing of a program that I couldn't tell. Is there a new line character sitting in there? Not the backslash n, which is our representation of, but there is a new line character that I can't see. Or maybe it's a bell character. Or maybe it's some other character, vertical tab. They have all kinds of characters that are unprintable. I'm saying you're not allowed to have those. What you'll do instead is for a few of them, I'll give you escape sequences. And for the rest of them, you'll have to compute them by doing something really nasty, like converting an integer by casting into a character. I'm making that kind of nasty because these are dangerous to use. So it's one of those sorts of situations where that you try to make getting at the things hard enough that you really have to know what you're doing and want to do it to do it. So inside there says you're not allowed to have a non-printable. You're also not allowed to have a backslash by itself. Why is that? Because then I'd misinterpret it as escaping the next character following it. But there's a way around that. And I can't have a double quote. Because if I had a double quote in the middle, I would not find a proper terminator. So this thing's like I can never have a double quote in the middle of a string unless I escape it. So the thing that says not all the way to the middle of the line are the things I may have represented in negation form. So can I have a letter? Yeah. It's not one of those. Can I have a digit? Yeah. Can I have a comma? Yeah. Can I have a semicolon? Yeah. Can I have a single quote? Yeah. Can I have a double quote? No. Because all the unprintables and backslash and double quote are not allowed in that component. But I have an OR symbol that says, if you want to have a double quote, escape it. So backslash, double quote there. If you want to have the new line character, that is the character which, when it's printed out at runtime, would skip you to the next line. And you do that all the time when you're doing prints. You know, if you want to start something in a new line, you include a backslash, new line there. Backslash T is tab. If you want to use a tab, people use that. And double backslash is a way to print a single backslash in escaped form. So if I see two consecutive backslashes, you're saying, I really mean a single one, but I couldn't use a single one because it would be misinterpreted as the beginning of an escape sequence. So this is probably one of the nastier ones you'll have to program. There's also a cognate that represents a character literal. And in that particular case, the difference between a character literal is you have a single quote terminated by a single quote and one or two letters or one or two characters in between. Typically one character, but if you want to have a magic character, you may need to have two. So a character literal begins with a single quote and ends with a single quote. Inside it, I can't have non-printables again. That's because I couldn't read them. I can't have an escape by itself because it'd be misinterpreted as an escape. And I can't have a single tick, a single quote, because it'd be misinterpreted as the end of the string. So in that particular case, I happen to have that. Notice this, because it doesn't have a plus on it, means I can't have a single character literal that contains, say, four characters. If I wanted to write something like tick, A, tick, I can't do that. I could write a string with double quotes or single quotes. But in this case, notice the maximum number of characters I can have are the two single quotes on either end, plus either one character if it's not special, or two characters backslash something if it is special. So this thing is controlling the length of what I scan. And if I try to give too long a string, like if I try to say tick, A, tick, the scanner is going to fail. It's not going to be able to scan tick, A, and find another tick. So it's going to say it's not a quoted string. Nothing else begins with a single quote that is a tick. So nothing else is going to match. So you'd end up getting an error symbol saying, error, this character is illegal in this context. And that sometimes happens. Other tokens are pretty easy. These are all the delimiters and operators we happen to have. Notice in some cases we can have things like equal versus double equal. No problemo. The scanner is going to be clever enough to figure out when you mean a single and when you mean a double. The rule would be if I had two consecutive assignments, two consecutive equals, it would say that's the equal comparison operator because the rule is you scan as long as you can. If I happen to have a single assignment or equal, that would be there because the next character was not a double equal, and therefore that's meant to be assignment and not the equality comparison operator. We also have to have an end the file token, but it turns out the scanner will give this to us automatically. Not quite done. I promised you a couple of others, but these are not so bad. We have a single line comment, and this is what I showed you before, but the final end of line at the end of the specification is missing. Can anybody guess why that is? Well, what this is going to do is it's going to go ahead and match double slash, not anything that's not an end of line. In most cases, it will hit an end of line, but I'm okay because white space is considered an end of line along with blank and tab. So it would really scan it in two steps. It says, I saw a comment, and then the end of line. I could have put the end of line there, but then I run into an unlikely but still possible error. Namely, at the very last line of a file, do I need to put an end of line? And the answer is no. If you think about it, we mostly think of end of lines as being a separator. A terminator. Just like you write a sentence, here is my dog, period. But in this particular case, If I didn't want to have an end of line at the very end, I don't need one, because an end of line doesn't mean anything, and I could stop the program one character sooner. You'd say, well, no sensible person would do that. But some of you are in quality assurance, aren't you? And people in quality assurance are not always sensible. Yeah, question. This end of line is not a character. It's a token. It's not a character. There's no ASCII character that says end of line. It's the absence of any more characters. Now, what some people do, and I don't recommend this, but it's possible, is they cheat and they create an end of line character by taking one of the unused ASCII character patterns and assigning to it. Because ASCII characters are only used 7 bits, so there's an unused bit you can play with. I think that's a little gross. It works. But in this particular case, that's why we don't do it. Namely, you can't scan an end of line. It's a situation, not a character. And that kind of makes sense, because you don't type end of line. When you're done typing, you do a command save or something, and you say, put the file away in the file system. But that thing does not say add an end of line if I don't have one. Because after all, maybe something where end of line is not needed. It could be a set of data that are not a program source. So anyway, so this sort of situation just goes to show you there's a little subtlety involved. The definition I showed in the notes is perfectly fine in 99.99% of the cases. But in this particular case, what would happen is if I had an end of line there, and I happen to have the very last line in my program was / goodbye, with the E being the very last character in the file, there would be no end of line and no need for it. Because remember, end of line in programs is used as a separator, not a terminator. And therefore, I only need a separator if there's something following me. It's a subtle point, and you certainly don't want to make too much of bother about it, but that's why that is the way it is. Here's the multi-line comment, which I talked through earlier. That's the alternative to /*/, which is the basis of homework number one. Once you understood homework number one, you'd be able to put it in, but I wanted you to be able to start the scanner as soon as you care to, and I don't want to give you the answer to homework one as part of the definition. So in this case, I changed things around a little bit. If you want, though, remember, you own the language. And if you want, at some point, you want to put /*/ in your language, you can certainly do it once you know the right way of doing it. So that's the cool thing about owning a language. You can put in what you want as long as you're clever enough to figure out how to do it. So that's all I wanted to say. And it's not really a bad set of tokens. Once we learn how to use JLEX, most of these things can be programmed in an afternoon. The quoted strings will probably be a problem. A couple of other things are, but it's not as bad a token sequence as you might have feared. So I have these cool patterns, and that's really what regular expressions are. But how in the world am I ever going to program them? Let's see, do I have... Yeah, suppose I... Well, we'll get to it in a bit. So I need to have a mechanism that says, if I want to actually match tokens and do them perfectly, what sort of mechanism do I have? It's going to be certainly something in the form, read a character, compare it with something. Read a character and compare it with something. But the question is what? And here's what we're going to do, is we're going to create a very simple mathematical logic or programming logic that is called a finite automaton. And a finite automaton is typically drawn on paper in terms of circles and arrows. So in this case, we have a set of states represented as circles, a set of transitions or arrows that represent a transition from one state to another. If you took 367 and you saw graphs, it's really a graph. A special state is called the start state. That's where you start from. And a subset of those states are states that represent being in a good spot. That is a spot where you found a valid token. Other states will be non-final, and they'll represent a partial but not a complete match. And here's the graphing of it. So a single circle is a state. Now, of course, we're not going to program it as a state, because I don't know any programming language that conveniently has arrows and circles in it. But for visualization, as a prelude to programming, it's fine. A transition will typically be marked, as I'll show you. A state with an arrow coming from nowhere is the start state, and a double circle, even hopefully well-adjusted, is an accepting state. That's one that says good token. Anything that's not a double circle is a bad token. That is, I have not found enough characters to represent something in my definition. It turns out, by the way, that the plural of automaton is automata, and sometimes people get confused by that. So the way we can represent a matching of a token is simply by a transition diagram. Yeah, here's the one I was thinking about. So let's look at the regular expression up top. That's just barely complex enough to maybe make you worry. It says, what do I want? It says, I want an A and a B, followed by one or more C's, and the combination of A, B, and C's can be repeated one or more times. If I asked you to program that with series of ifs, if the character equals A, do this, if equals B, do that, equals C, do that, you might have trouble programming it. Certainly, getting a readable program might be an issue. An alternative, however, is this logic diagram. Think of this as what your program is going to do statement to statement, but without actually programming it. So this thing says, I start at the far left where the arrow comes in from nowhere, and it says, what you got to do is you got to match an A. It's my only choice. It says, once I'm in that second from the left, I got to match a B. No choice. If I get to that state and read a C, I go to an accepting state, double circle. It says, yeah, that means ABC is acceptable. Now, the rightmost state has two arrows. It says, if I see a C, stay in the final state and keep matching C's. If I want, I can go back and read another A. That represents iterating the outer plus, but then I have to match a B and one more C. So I would argue that the diagram on the bottom, once you're comfortable with it, is easier to understand than the thing at the top. And all we have to then do is figure out how to program bits of code that match that logic. It says, where I started from, I got to see an A, then I got to see a B, then I've got to see a C, and then I can stop. Or I can see a C and stop, or I can read an A, but now I don't stop. I go back and read another B and another C. Well, it turns out, of the automata we see, we want a particular kind of automata, and fortunately, we can always have it if we want it, called deterministic. And a deterministic says that any transition has to be a situation there where it can have only one arrow for a given character, and it's not allowed to use lambda. There's another variety of automata that are allowed to use lambda and are allowed to have multiple outgoing arrows. The reason for that, going back, is pretty simple. If I happen to have something where I had two arrows from the rightmost state with A, the question is, which one should I follow? It turns out that this sounds kind of spooky, but the way a mathematician would handle this is says handle both. And that's a little tricky because whenever you have a choice, but remember, in some ways, if you have a choice, if you can make both choices, what does that mean? Well, in some sense, it means you might be able to backtrack. Some early games had that way, or better than that. I don't know if any of you play Sudoku, you know, the thing with the numbers and the grids. And some of the really, really nasty ones, the hardest ones, are such that you can't figure out what a particular solution is purely on logic. What you have to do is make a guess and say, okay, I'm down to this point where I know this is either a 0 or a 1. I'll try a 0 and see if it gets me to a jam state where I happen to have an illegal representation. If I don't go there, it wins. Otherwise, I have to backtrack and try a 1. Now, I actually hate those because it ruins the game. It ought to be that just by logic and inference, you should be able to figure out what the next character and the next character is. But you can imagine having programs that do a similar thing. When it can't be sure which one to do, it tries one, does it work? Not failing that, it tries another. The danger with that is you can have an exponential effect. Each of the two guys try two choices, that's 4, 8, 16, and so on, and that's bad. But it turns out there's a way of handling that we'll get to. And for our purposes, we'll be working at this stage with the deterministic automata. And the reason for that is they're real easy to translate into programs. And in fact, JLEX will do that for you. So you don't even have to look at these things and say, I'll program this, I'll program that. So in this case, we're going to require always a unique transition. Let me go back and say one more thing. going back to this automata, there are some states that don't have arrows for all possible characters. That's perfectly okay. If I read an A and then saw a C, what would happen is I would stop at the leftmost state. I could not go on any further. And since I'm not in a final state, that would be a representation of an arrow. An error. So that would mean that if I read an A followed by a C, it would read the A, say, I can't go any further. Therefore, this pair, AC, cannot be a valid token. We'll figure out how to handle that. Typically, what scanners do is it takes the very first character, which turned out to be not workable, calls it an error, and starts with the next character. In our situation, AC, that wouldn't work either. So it would say A is incorrect, followed by C is incorrect. Hopefully, eventually, you get back to a valid pattern, and the scanner starts working again, as expected. So it turns out there are two ways of programming this. The way JLEX does it is it's going to create a table that encodes the logic of this diagram. But it's possible, and there are some scanner generators that actually generate code that you could read as a human. But it does all the detail work of saying, what do I do if I see an A? What do I do if I see a B? And so on. So let's look at this example. And this is the one with the end of line in. And again, I could try it without it, but this one gives me an extra character to play with. So one way to do it is the way JLEX would do it. It says, here's the diagram up above. It says, I see a slash, and then I see another slash. And if I see an end of line, I'm fine. Otherwise, I keep reading non-end of line. Notice not EOL represents really many transitions that are there. So they're all superimposed with the saying anything that's not an end of line. That's 127 different characters in ASCII. So any one of those 127 is fine. And away we go. So in this case, I'm just doing it in terms of a slash end of line A, B, and I guess, and what's the blank? And let's see, three going to, oh, that's everything else. Yeah, that's everything else. So that should be all the other characters. So the way to read this is as a table. It says, if I'm in state one and I see a slash, go to state two. If I'm in state two and see a slash, go to state three. If I'm in state three and see an end of line, go to state four, and then I can stop. If I'm in state four and I can read any character at all, no, I can't read any character at all, I'm sorry. I'm in state three and I can read anything other than end of line, that takes me to state three and I keep looping. So this is a table version of essentially what was our logic diagram. The thing about this fits in really easy in code. I simply make a two-dimensional array, one indexed by the state number and the other by the character. And I have a state that I go to, or a blank says, it's error, you can't go to any state. And therefore, this is very flexible as a way of programming. So here's the actual driver, as it's called. So if I had this little table sitting somewhere and it was accessible, it says, what do I want to do? I start at the start state, so my variable state says here. If I'm at the end of file, and in this case is where we're doing that trick about end of file character, just in this case to not have to worry about end of file marker. In JLEX, end of file is not a character, and therefore this wouldn't fully work. So it says, if I hit the end of file, stop, break, because I can't read anymore. And what I'll do is I'll go down to the bottom three lines. Otherwise, I look up the next state. So look up T of state and current character. And a blank is considered an error. So if the next state is a blank, that is error, I break, go to the bottom three lines. Otherwise, I update my state to be next state, read another character, and go back in the loop and keep reading. And this is an infinite loop until I hit an end of file, and then I break out. If I'm at the bottom, it says, well, let's look at state. Is it in a list or a table of accepting states? If so, I know what it is, and I can process it. Otherwise, I signal that I had a lexical error. My scanner would not scan that particular sequence under the logic diagram I had. It's possible, if I wanted to eliminate the table and fill this in actually in terms of logic that you might program. The advantage here is you don't program this. The scanner generates it. So it would say this is explicit control. The advantage of this is that it's easier for a human to read. And by the way, is that necessarily a great advantage? Say, oh, hey, that's cool. I've got the code in front of me. I can change it if necessary. Well, again, how many people here are in quality assurance? Got to be some. And quality assurance, yeah, people. Quality assurance is actually one of the most important departments in any organization, including this one. So when you're up for review and possible raises, you can quote me on that. And the reason for that is you only get one chance to make a bad first impression. What that means is if the quality assurance people, these are the people that says this product works, it works well, it's high quality. If you mess up and something goes out the door and a user finds an error, that's not so good. The user finds many errors, it's really not so good because Epic has a reputation of selling really high quality products. So the trouble with something like this is oh, I can just go in there and program it. But one of the problems with fixing bugs, and again, QA people know this, is sometimes when you fix a bug, you unintentionally introduce a new bug. So what QA people do is not just see, is this error fixed, but typically taking the revised program that has the quote fix, they run a whole suite of tests, very much like we're going to do when we test your program in grading, and say, do all these things still work? It's certainly possible you may have fixed this one, but had another problem. Have you ever seen something where somebody tries to nail down a warped board? You're down there and the board is warped on one end, so you go over there and start nailing, and the other side pops back up. So it's kind of like that in programming. You fix one thing, and by fixing one thing, another thing may go wrong. You say to yourself, oh, I'm not so stupid. I'd never do something like that. But it turns out you're unlikely to have been the person who wrote the program, and a lot of times there's some subtle assumptions built in that you don't know about. And unless they're very well documented, you may break that rule, and all of a sudden something that relies upon it fails. So having this thing looking like it's code is good. But remember, if I have a generator, what I could do is even better is fix it up at the token level and the regular expression level, regenerate this thing. Maybe it looks a lot like this, or maybe it looks changed, but it's automatically generated. And therefore, if something messes up, it's not my fault. I defined the tokens correctly. It's Mr. JLEX. Go back and sue him. Unfortunately, JLEX is distributed for free. So usually when you get something for free, proving damages is kind of hard. So you get what you pay for. But JLEX has been around a while, and it's pretty reliable. So this thing said, okay, it's going to do exactly what the previous program did, but there's no tables now. So you can, in fact, read the logic. And again, that's somewhat positive. I like to be able to read code. So it says, if the current character is a slash, read another character. If the current character is a slash, repeat reading the other character until I hit an end of file or an end of line. I then fall to the bottom, and it says, if the current character is end of line, fine, I've got a valid token. Otherwise, it must have been an end of file I hit, and I'm going to signal a lexical error. So this thing is reasonably readable and automatically generated. So that's cool. We're going to use JLEX, which generates the table, but you're never going to have to look at the table. So that's a big plus. Let's look at a few more examples, and then, yeah, it'll be time for a break, and then we'll actually start getting into JLEX, and you can start actually thinking about doing scanning. So here's a case where I want to show both the finite automaton and the expression. And it turns out there is a rule, or not rule, but algorithms, that says if I have a regular expression like real lit, I can generate a diagram like that. And this is actually internally what JLEX does. You program in something that looks like the real lit definition. It translates it into a logic diagram that corresponds to that particular automaton. Turns out I probably won't go into it, but if somebody wants it, I can show you where it is in the textbook. You can actually go backwards. If I have an automaton here, I can go back to a regular expression that represents it. Sometimes it's clean, sometimes it's not. But what this thing is saying is that, let's see what it is in English. So I want a real literal, and I require digits on one or both sides, but I'm not going to allow digits on neither side. So that means I'm going to have 1 point, 3.14 is fine, 1.0, 0.01, but I can't have just a decimal point. because that's not a number. You've got to have some digits. So that thing represents it, but notice it looks kind of funny because I've got a D star, a D plus, a lambda, and an or sign. And looking at that thing, you say, what in the world is this guy doing? If I look at the diagram below, it's a tad more readable. Let me go ahead. It says, okay, if I read a dot, notice there I've reached the state that's not final. So it's saying, for sure, I don't want a dot. If I take a digit, it says, if I see a digit, fine, that's a final state. So an integer like 1, 2, 3 is fine. I can read additional digits. I can read a trailing decimal, and that would take me to something like 1 point. That's fine. I could read another digit, like 1.2. Up top, I could read a dot, which is not acceptable, but I could read a dot followed by a digit, like 0.1 or 0.11, and that's acceptable. So I would argue that the bottom diagram is easier to read, but we just had the signal to stop talking. So when I start up again, we'll go back to that one and kind of read our way through that one, which is equivalent, but I would argue less readable. So we'll let you kind of ponder on that. Again, it's quarter of, so let's pick up again about 8 p.m. and we'll have our final half-hour session.